This interview was for the Russell Library Oral History Project. Being interviewed is Reverend Lorenzo Woods on Wesleyan University campus at the Malcolm X House. Today's date is March the 11th, 1976. Reverend Woods, can you tell us about the first time you came to Middletown, what year it was, and your first impressions of the city?
I came here from Brooklyn, New York in 1947. And at that time, I was in high school, and I came directly to Portland, which is 1 mile from Middletown. It separates Middletown and Portland by the bridge. And I only spent 1 day in the Portland school systems because the curriculum was not conducive that I could pursue my studies that I had in Brooklyn, New York. So I only spent 1 day in Portland High School, and I transferred immediately to the Middletown High School. Well, conditions that at that time were very, very, very tough for black people. One incident, I got almost kicked out of school because I protested, because in my senior year, upon a graduation, the classes would go to Washington. And I was told then that if I went, and I was going to go, and I graduated in the top half of my class, and I had spent all those years in high school, and I was told that if I went, I could not stay in the same hotel as the whites. So that when we went to assembly and they stood up and they said they pledged to allegiance, I ended, you know, with the part when he says, with liberty and justice for all. I ended with liberty, with justice, liberty and justice for all but me. And at that point, I was expelled from school. So I didn't get a chance to go to Washington. I blankly said that I wasn't going to go because why should I have gone through high school with all these people? And at the end, then I was going to be segregated. I wasn't segregated in class, so why should I then go to Washington, the nation's capital that makes the laws, and be segregated? So I demanded that I wasn't going to go, and I asked the class not to go. But they went anyway. So that was my first confrontation. I never had any confrontation with segregation until I came here in Middletown. Because I always grew up with Jews, and you know they were oppressed people too, so we were all in the same bag together. So I never experienced it until I came here in Middletown. Of course, this is a very small, you know, community, and you would find it in these little small New England communities. That was the first confrontation I had with, and it was a great one. We had a revolution from the moon where that's concerned. My mother was called in a paper, a black paper. From Hartford, they covered the story, but the Middletown Press did not touch that because it was too touchy, you know, you would disturb some of the elites here in this city, so it wasn't carried at all. But I was expelled from school because of this unpatriotic type of response.
Were there many black students in the school system at that time, or in your particular high school?
Not that many. There were about, as far as I can remember, in the graduating class, there were about 5 of us. And incidentally, I see them sporadically now, not as often as I'd like to, because they've since moved away and got their own professions and so forth. But there is one that I'm very chummy with, Wardell Moody, who is still in this area. And none of us went as a result of what they did to me.
After graduation from high school, what type of plans did you have for the future, and how did you go about pursuing these plans?
Well, when I graduated, upon graduating, you see, in our yearbook, I finally got into that. My ambition was to attend Wesleyan. And of course, I got all the brochures, and of course, I found out later that Wesleyan was not admitting any of the blacks, any blacks at that point. Of course, others I've read since then had gotten in, but they were so close to whites that they crossed the line per se. But naturally, I, you know, seeing my car, I can't pass anywhere. I'm obvious, you see. so that I, when I sent my picture in, I never heard. And so I wasn't accepted. So then, before I came from New York, I used to take organ and voice and things like that. So but then I altered my education, and I went to Juilliard High School of Music in Hartford. And there I studied for 4 years. And I still determined, I was determined to graduate from Wesleyan. That was the fire that burned within me. It wasn't a matter of how long I did it, how long it took me to do it. I thought it was a good thing for me to do. So that when community college came into this town, and that was almost 15, 20 years after I had applied, and I still had that thought, I lived here, I have a right to go here, and so I pursued it. So that when my oldest child flew out to Harum Scott College in Nebraska, I then applied for the community college. And I finished community college, and I finished at a 3.5 average, and they had to let me in. So that they did, at that time, blacks were here. Mm-hmm. But
what year was that?
That was in 1970, excuse me for the dates, but I'm right, very shallow where dates are concerned. Mm-hmm. But around 1969, 1970, I finally got here. Now that was, mm-hmm. I was
that's
an old man.
Time.
I waited. And, you know, I always tell my children, whatever you want, you pursue it. And, you know, you alter your situation. If you, psychology tells us, if we pursue something and something gets in our way, then you find another avenue by which to get to your goal. So I did. And I got here, and I took some courses, and I was accepted in the Department of Religion. Mm-hmm. And I got that degree. And when I did, when Colin gave me that degree, I smiled right in his face, and in my heart I said, well, I made it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it.
Reverend Woods, can you tell us about your community involvement in terms of how you became associated with Shiloh Baptist Church and the type of things you've seen in the black community in that position?
Well, our church started out with 12 members, and I got the call into the ministry, and I was a member of the church. And in turn, they were looking for a minister when our older minister resigned. And consequently, being there, they, and knowing the congregation and knowing the things that went on, they just secured my services. Well, in that time, you know, housing was a problem, employment was a problem, and naturally, the black church is geared to help in helping black people to survive, you see, in any aspect. You know, you just can't say, well, a black church is interested in this. It has to be interested in the whole gamut of the other human being, you see, in which other churches, white churches, don't have to be involved, you know, don't have to be that involved because they've got money and, you know, they got ahead of us in education. So a lot of things they don't need, but we need all of it. And a black minister has to be in a position to, though some people think that he's a man of every hour, he isn't, but he has to serve all aspects that involve the lives of black people. So that when I got into my ministry, I saw in this community where housing was concerned, I saw a lot of our people moving from the area because there was no housing open for our black people. They were going out of the city for housing, and they were going out of the city for jobs and for all kinds of opportunities that other people that were available to other people. And I sat back and I saw my church dwindling. You know, I saw people moving away. And I said to myself, well, I can't have the lights to go out here. I have to people love the church. But in loving the church, if they can't find things that would help them to survive, they're going to move where things where these things are offered. So then I got involved in housing. And at that point, it was around the 60s, you know, when we had the trouble with Martin Luther King. Wesleyan got into the aspect of a revolving fund, which was $1 million, that they said, listen, Middletown community, we want to do something. And at that point, I was hired by the Chamber of Commerce in a position, HOC, Housing Opportunity Counseling. And this gave me an opportunity in my church to supply a part of a down payment, not the down payment. If these individuals had any money at all, we could add to their money that they have for a down payment and purchase a house, which gives us prestige, gives us some kind of insight as to where we're going. Because these people were paying exorbitant rents, and they lived in the worst neighborhoods in the community. So it was up to me to go out and find housing to give these people some kind of hope, you see. So that's what I got. And I got about 40-some-odd families in the church housing in this community. Now, we were very careful not to put them all in the same area. We dispersed them here and there and everywhere. We had some problems wherein a lot of the whites got panic and they started moving out. And it was my job to train, you know, because we have to teach them, you know, that that is, isn't anything to be afraid of but fear itself. And what you don't know, that thing you're afraid of. And some of the little things these whites would be disturbed with, that the blacks would leave their laundry on the line for over the weekend. Now, that's picky, but that's the thing that they find to pick on, you see. Mm-hmm. Or your children, you know, running over the grass. All right, those little picky things, we have to teach them, you know, that isn't your business. As long as the person is keeping up the house, keeping up the property, mm-hmm. then these little picayune things, which you're finding all kinds of cases why you should be disturbed, because they're there. You see, the main purpose is that you're trying to look over the reason these blacks are there is to live. So I got into that. Then we got into the avenue of employment, and I tried to get involved in that area by getting into the service organizations and knowing people and having all the banks to know me and so forth and so on. So I was president of the clergy association in this city, and then I was elected to, I was the first black to be elected to the used to be Middletown Savings Bank, which is now known as the Liberty Savings Bank of Middletown. I was also voted as the corporator of Middletown, of that bank, corporator of Middlesex Hospital. I was elected to the Board of Big Brothers, elected to the Board of Boy Scouts, and I was a chairman. I was a chaplain for the Kiwanis. So that gave me an avenue by which I could know all these people, you know, who could have ways by which I could tap into things that I would need in this city. So those were the things I got involved in to help black people.
During this time in the community, did you notice a particular type of image or impact that Wesleyan had on the black community? Perhaps you might want to deal with the image first, that it was how it was perceived by the blacks in the community.
Well, prior to all of this, we felt, and I concur, we felt that Wesleyan was the traditional, it had an image of the of perpetuating the white, the WASP image. You know, the Anglo-Saxon white WASP, you know, the elite, you know, up on the hill. And it was perceived as a city within a city, wherein if you saw them downtown, you could basically point them out. They had this image, you know, all of them looked alike and so forth and so on. And they never, you know, gave the idea that they were in the town to do the town or any of the minority people any good, so that we were afraid of them. Because naturally, the common people, which did not have degrees, would be afraid. And I think at some point, some of those people still have those same ideas that because I don't have a degree, I'm afraid of them, you know, but that isn't so. My mother has always told me that if you want a big fool, a good fool, you get an educated one, he can be the biggest fool in the world. And I always maintain that it is not the per se the ignorant person. And I always question this idea of ignorance, because at some point, you see, everybody knows something that another person does not know. I don't care how educated you are, how ignorant somebody thinks you are. You know something that other person don't know. So where is the point of of brilliance? Where is the point of being per se ignorant? What is that? You see, how do you define that? So I'm saying this. A lot of people say, "Well, the black church to cater to the ignorant and the poor." I don't see it being that because right now, as educated as I think I am, my mama, who only went to the third grade, can beat me counting any day. So you see, where is the point of being educated? And how can you say a person is educated or dumb or so forth and so on? So Wesleyan was looked upon as being the elite and the educated people, and we have nothing to do with those types of people. But recently, it has changed.
I'm also curious, as the student population began to have more black students, did that make any difference? Positively or negatively.
Well, there again, the students that come here, and I've seen this happen, the students that come here, I don't know where they come from because we don't ever see them. And I'm just hoping that the black students who come to Wesleyan are not being whitewashed, wherein they get a different perspective, wherein they get so polished that you can't, you don't know whether or not they're black or if they talk. And I've heard many people say this, that some of them here are so polished that you can't tell them from whites. And this is a bad thing, you know. We should not forget where we come from. And that's what a lot of these students are doing. And I can say, because I spent 2.5 years here, and that's what I've seen. I've said in classes, although, you know, and no one speaks perfectly English all the time. No one. But some of these kids, you wonder. And they don't get in the community. You don't see them in the community. You don't see them, you know, visiting the black churches, or they're here. And so the same way the blacks think about the whites, they're thinking about these newer blacks who are coming through. Well, there are, my church is one of the largest black churches in this community. It was an association of about 60 churches. About 60 churches. The Catholic, you know, the Protestant and the Catholic people. And once a month we would meet and talk over problems, you know, of where we could best serve, you know, and general format for holidays that would come up that we could all come together and be as one. And I was the vice president of that association.
I was wondering before about how much involvement there was between
the whites.
Yeah.
Well, at the inception of it, there wasn't too much involvement. But as the blacks became visible, you see, you know, just like the idea of when the horse and buggy was invented, the horse was afraid to pull it. But then when they got him used to it, he pulled it, you see. So that when we first got involved with this thing, naturally anything from the section of anything, you know, it's very clumsily gotten off. But as we got integrated with one another and became familiar and knowing one another, then, you know, they visit. And even today, I can have something at my church. I have a lot of white people who come. A lot of white people. And indeed, my church is sort of integrated because of marriage, intermarriages, and so forth.
This is going to be a really broad question. I just want to know, like, a general history of Shiloh, because I don't have anything written, and I just wanted your reflections on when the church was started. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was in the origin of the church. The church was organized in 19. If I can get the date correct, I'm very shallow with dates. I tell you, I'm getting old now. But the church started in 1958. It was started in my mother's living room, and so it grew. And at that time, there were not many black people in this area. You see, it's like the extended family. They come north, where jobs are in the offering, and then, you know, in the summertime they get money and they buy that big car and they go back home and say, "Honey, look what I've got." And then the cousins, you know, they come up, and then from that point it started growing. And so and naturally the bulk of the black people from the South were Baptist or Methodists. And then later on years, and you have the Holiness churches and so forth. But our church is the second oldest black church in this vicinity. And as I say, I have been with them for 18 of those 25, 26 years. And we're going to celebrate our anniversary the first week in April.
When you first started, how did you all finance the first building? Did you have like a building plan or anything?
Well, now, that was a problem because at that point, you know, blacks were not considered to be stable, and no bank would give them any fine. I had an awful time. As a matter of fact, when we purchased that first church, and it wasn't a new church, it was an old dilapidated one. We just couldn't find anything around. We just, and our people did not have the money to, per se, you know, shell it out of their pockets. So we went to the bank, and the bank wouldn't give us any money. So then, when we thought we wanted a bigger edifice, we went up here on Liberty and High Street, and at that point, these people were in the process of building a new church around here on Washington Street, the Lutheran Church. They told us we could have that church for $25,000. I didn't have $5, so that, and the parsonage went with the church, and I said to the minister, "You keep the parsonage, just give us the church." So he gave us the church for $18,000. And he said that if I give him half of the money down, or no, we'd have to pay him three quarters of the money down. Well, I didn't have a quarter of the money. So that I went to the bank again to see if they could help. Nope, they wouldn't help us out at all. So that I went back to him again. He says, "All right, if you give me, what do you say, $3,000, then you pay the rest every 6 months." Well, now, with a handful of members, that made it very difficult. So what I did, he wrote the contract, gave him the $3,000, we wrote the contract to pay, $2,000 every 6 months, plus taking on our current expenses, our ongoing expenses. And I didn't take a dime from those people helping them to buy that church. And then what I did, I went into the community and I ran a campaign every 6 months. And every 6 months we had that $2,000 until we paid it off. Mm-hmm. So I think we had 3 years to pay for it. We paid for it in 2.5 years. But that's how we got that church. So then we stayed there until it burned down. And being as old as it was, we didn't get but $35,000 from the building because it was too old.
In terms of your new church, how was that financed? Or how was this?
Well, the new church cost us over $250,000. We only got $35,000 from the old church. Well, since I have been in the program of getting black people housing from Wesleyan's revolving fund, I asked them, would they, and since I attended Wesleyan, I graduated from Wesleyan, and they said that I was a great asset to the community, then why not then help, you know? So I asked Colin Campbell, and he said to me, "Good, we will help you." And they loaned us $115,000 with 1% interest. Well, now the loan matured December the 31st, and we owe them with the interest $116,000. So I have gone back to Colin and said, "Well, we only raised $25,000 on that $116,000. Well, now you see, it's an impossibility for us to take a mortgage of some $90,000. So I'm confronting them with this problem now. See, and if they want a further help, then they will have to, you know, see what they can do."
I was wondering, when a church moves and there's sometimes you're you lose some of your members, and I know that Shiloh moved far, you know, pretty far out. And I was wondering how did the membership, were most people in favor of that move?
Well, they had to because first of all, the state. You see, I was also connected with Long Lane, and since they were on all, one day I was passing me. I said, "Well, not gracious, this is state property." I was kind of reluctant about seeing, about that property because I know state involved property. At the time, Governor Miskell was the governor, and I called his office, and he called me back and said that he was going to send two men down. There were three pieces of property I looked at. He said to see which piece of property we wanted, and we chose the one on Butternut Street. The state turned it over to us on a lease of 100 years at $100 per year. Now, that's almost a gift, and I'm working on some of the aspects of turning the property over to us completely, because in the lease they said that it would never be used for anything. Or if it isn't going to be used for anything, why not do some good toward black people once in their life? So now I'm working on that to get that turned over. Where black will, our people concerned, all of them got cars anyway. Mm-hmm. Because the jobs are not next door to their homes. So if they used to come a mile here, they can come a mile and a half there. Now, I have not seen, because I work so fast that, you know, we had the church up in a year or so. Because if you don't, you know, as you said, they will start drifting. So I had to work relatively fast. So I got the church up. We had some problems because the builder put things in there that I had not authorized, the congregation had not authorized him to put these things in the building, and it ran over $45,000. So we had been in a litigation with him because we're almost dissolving, so now we're just about coming out of that situation, but we got the church up. It is costing us money, but what can you have unless you have to pay for it? So I have not seen a decline in the, as a matter of fact, we have baptized since we've been in that church, we baptized some 28, some 30 people. And because, you know, new broom sweeps clean, you know, new church, mm-hmm. Everybody wants to belong to the biggest and the best and the beautiful, most beautiful church. How long it'll last, I don't know.
I know in the black community, especially in Middletown, but I think it's true everywhere, employment is always a big question. And I'm curious about the influx of blacks from the South and cities that are a little bit closer to Middletown. What types of problems or successes did they encounter in finding employment? And also in terms of Wesley, since this is one of the bigger institutions, did this seem to be a problem or was it an exception to the rule?
That Wesleyan would employ a lot of the black people?
Just in terms of the general employment
picture.
Well,
in this area, you're talking about the ordinary layperson. Are you talking about the person with degrees that would be on the high echelon?
I'm talking just in general.
Yeah, in general.
Just in general.
All right. Well, basically, black people in this area usually work one of three places. Either the hospital, Middlesex Memorial Hospital, or the Connecticut Valley Hospital. And then another big employer would be Pratt Whitney, wherein they get on all different shifts, the first, second, or third shift. And Pratt Whitney has drawn people even from Hartford to this area. I have gotten people, I've gotten members. Indeed, when I was working for Hawk, I got involved with employment. People who come down from Hartford asking me were there places to rent. And in turn, moving here, I was successful in getting them members, between members. Now, where Weston is concerned, I have one of my deacons who works in the housing department here, and a lot of my members who work at the housing on that level. But on the higher echelon, I don't know if they're in. I'm not familiar with the jobs that would be offered in the menial, let's call it menial jobs. And how many are there to be offered, you see? So I do know some of my people, but not the other ethnic people. I don't know how many would be around it.
I was just, when I asked the question, I guess I was thinking in terms of the fact that it was an influx of the black,
populace.
Black populace, mm-hmm. and how this might have affected, institutions that were present in the city who weren't accustomed to having jobs open to the segment.
Being within themselves, I don't think Risen would have, unless somebody would pressure them to get into that type of situation. They got into the situation because there are a group of white and black women who came and asked them, since you got holdings in South Africa, can't you do something here in Middletown? So they were pressured to get into this housing, into this housing type thing. Now, unless another group would come in and find a good way they could do it, I don't know if they would get into this employment type of thing. Other than what they do right here on campus.
In terms of community sponsors,
they say, well, you can get a job.
Yeah.
Now, you want to know specific year?
Well, not year, but like, was it, in the 50s or was it as late as the 60s?
It must have been. The great influx came about 59 to 60. Mm-hmm. That's when the influx came. That's when Pratt & Whitney opened up, and naturally they had to be an equal opportunity employee. And that's when the telephone started ringing. Honey, you better come on, you can get a job. And that's when everybody came, But then it posed a problem because, you got jobs, but you know where to live. So then the blacks would have to crowd up, live with Aunt Nellie, and that crowded her because she was already crowded,